Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
There will be a moment when humans cease to be human. As we continue to advance therapies that today correct medical problems and restore normal function, many experts think the next logical step is to apply that technology to make already healthy brains and bodies better. Someday, we may not blink at the use of drugs, bionic implants, even genetic manipulations designed to make us superhuman. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. As tantalizing as it is to imagine ordering Olympic-quality physiques or genius-level IQs for our children, the ability to buy our way to physical and mental perfection will surely change what it means to be human and could create a kind of chasm between the haves and have-nots that dwarfs the concerns we have today about income and social inequality. Michael Best joins us to talk about all this. He is Chancellor's Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. His new book is called Our Grandchildren Redesigned, Life in the Bioengineered Society of the Near Future. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thanks for inviting me.
How does a historian become so focused on what the future might hold for humankind?
Well, I've always been interested in, I've always specialized in post-1945 history. I was a journalist for a while, so I'm interested in fairly what historians would consider recent history. And what started to happen back in the 1990s, I'm very interested in science fiction, and I started asking myself questions about how soon some of these sci-fi realities that were being depicted in movies and novels might actually become real in our lives. And as I started paying more and more attention, it was shocking to me. When you're actually reading the news with that in mind, you kind of see it popping up every day in different ways. And I started realizing a lot of the things that we have considered to be a far-off sci-fi Jetsons future actually could be a reality within a decade or two.
What's remarkable is that most of that science fiction doesn't assume that things will be awesome when we can do all these things. It always deals with our anxieties about the ability to change ourselves.
Yeah, there's one recent film with Bradley Cooper that actually takes the opposite tack and says, you know, this person will become, in many ways, will overcome any of the setbacks that the chemical augmentation of his cognition will bring about and actually allow him to sort of own the world. And that's an unusual take. Normally, it's much more dystopian and all kinds of bad things happen and there's a sort of underlying moral, you know, thou shalt not mess with the human body and mind or, there will be consequences.
To the extent that we've already started changing what it means to be human, we have the ability to correct a number of problems, restore normal health to people who have problems. If this is considered almost universally acceptable, Michael, why are we so unsure about whether it's a good idea to enhance normal bodies and brains?
Well, people have a sort of intuitive feeling of, you know, what's the normal range of human behavior? And most people don't have any problem with restoring that or repairing something that, you know, part of our body that's broken and trying to restore. There's a spectrum of what we consider normal function. If you mapped it, there it's probably a kind of a bell curve of what is the range of human, you know, personality traits and physical ability. People can run, you know, certain speeds and not below, not above. And that there's an intuitive sense that that is the range of normal. Going beyond that, you start to, it depends on which type of capacity you're boosting. If you're boosting the ability to run fast, maybe that's not considered as essential to our identity. But if you're boosting, let's say, the ability to recall things from your brain and through memory, there comes a point where you start to wonder, is this person still operating anywhere near the spectrum of what we would consider a normal human? And if you start adding these types of, let's say, cognitive or an ability to control your emotions, at some point you start entering a gray area where you're really wondering, can we call this person sufficiently like us still to be considered part of our species, part of the species typical category?
Does the ability to prevent something like children being born with particular disabilities or diseases contribute to an obligation to do so?
To prevent them?
Yeah.
Well, I think to the extent that there's some controversy. For instance, in the deaf community, there's been some controversy. Some deaf parents have opted to have deaf children when technologically, scientifically, medically, it might be possible to have children who would not be deaf because they value the special qualities of community that arise through the world of deaf people, the social world, the cultural world. But that's been very controversial even within the deaf community. By and large, I think most people have no hesitation about saying if somebody's going to be born with something well below the normal level of human functioning and it can be easily adjusted so that it brought back up to normal, most people have no problem with that.
Of course, we can imagine a future where everyone has been enhanced in some way to function better than normal. You know, our senses are sharper, our cognition is quicker. And then there's a question about whether there's an obligation to enhance, just like the people down the block.
Yeah, so that, first of all, one of the things that I've concluded is people are probably not going to enhance themselves in similar ways. Hmm. Just as today, people, you know, buy different kinds of houses, choose different kinds of lifestyles and jobs, choose to read different kinds of books and so forth, there's going to be a tremendous proliferation of enhancements, both in all three of the categories, pharmaceuticals, electronic implants, interfacing with machines, genetic alterations. The combinations are mind-boggling. You can imagine all kinds of different combinations. And so they won't all necessarily be operating at similar levels. You're not simply, what I'm envisioning is not a society where everybody is boosted in the same ways and you know, everybody has the same level of cognition. And there will, of course, be probably a sizable minority of people who refuse any enhancements at all, whether for religious reasons or because they believe in the ecological balance of nature and they don't want to upset that. So when I try to envision this future, it's still a fairly diverse future. And you're going to get all kinds of people with moral attitudes toward, first of all, is it acceptable at all, or should we be messing with our bodies and minds at all, or is that something we should leave to what nature, or if you're religious, what God has provided? And then within the range of enhancements, you're going to get all kinds of, this is bad, this is okay. You're going to get a wide range of moral views about what constitutes a legitimate enhancement.
All right, let's talk about this catchphrase, designer babies.
Yes.
When we throw it around, we tend to imagine like really shallow parents who want to order a child of a particular sex or who grows to a certain height or has eyes a certain color.
Yeah.
One thing that you make clear is that at least as things stand right now, there are no guarantees, even if we think we've identified a particular gene for something.
Yeah, the designer baby is, the concept is that we would modify the baby's DNA at the moment of conception or very soon thereafter when the fetus is still in the blastocyst stage, 8 cells or something like that, and then whatever modification you made to the DNA would propagate through all the subsequent generations of cells that make up the adult organism. So you've inserted a change which will then express itself after the baby is gestated and born and develops into an adult. One of the things that has struck me, that always struck me as the most far-fetched of the design of the scenarios for human enhancement, because I think although some parents might not hesitate to do that for their children, thinking, well, we'll boost the child's cognition because that's always an advantage in society, and we're willing to, you know, give our kid SAT prep courses, so why shouldn't we want to boost the child's cognition to give him or her the best possible chances later on down the line? I think there would also be many parents who would be resistant to tinker with personality traits, say that's a propensity for wonderful musical ability or something like that, just because they would be nervous about infringing on the autonomy of their kids. And I think, so when we talk about designer babies, I think if scientists come up with a genetic alteration that could be done to the DNA at that moment of conception and confer robust resistance to cancer, then I think many parents will sign on, and it would be very few who would resist it. But if it's starting to mess with some of the things that make us distinctively who we are, our thinking, our feeling, our personality, then I think many parents would resist. But what has happened over the past 10 or 15 years is there's been a new branch of genetics that has sort of opened up, and biologists are very excited about it. It's called epigenetics. And basically, with epigenetics, you can make changes to how the genes express themselves. You don't change the underlying DNA. The underlying DNA stays the same. What you change are the molecular regulatory mechanisms that cause certain parts of the DNA to remain silent or unexpressed and cause other parts of the DNA to be expressed at greater levels. So you can sort of turn up the volume knob on certain sections of DNA and turn down the volume knob on others. Now, when you're doing that, you are profoundly modifying physical and mental and emotional traits. And what's striking about this new possibility is that you could do it at any point in a person's life. You don't have to do it at the moment of conception. So then the whole question of autonomy, you're sort of skirting around it, because let's say after age 21, when you're considered by society to be a full adult, a legal adult, then you could say, well, now you're old enough to, if you choose, make alterations to how your genetic makeup. And these could be very powerful tools that could influence not just physical traits, but also mental and emotional traits as well. And so that suddenly brought genetic alteration and genetic engineering into a much more realistic range of possibilities for me, whereas before I'd considered designer babies to be a little bit far-fetched.
As we work to understand what particular genes do for us and how they function, it's become clear that some might be associated with multiple effects. So,
Yes. Like
there's this evidence of a link between extraordinary creativity and susceptibility to certain kinds of mental illness. If we chose to design ourselves or design our babies to be spared any risk of something like bipolar disorder, might we also deprive ourselves or that child of her potential to be the next Picasso?
Well, one of the big questions in all of this is unintended effects, unintended consequences. And I look at that in the book, both at the level of individuals who, sort of try to create a certain modification in order to get a certain result and end up with something quite different than they had hoped, but also at the social level, when hundreds of thousands or millions of people are adopting modifications, what will be the unintended effects that you see in society as a whole? And when I'm talking with my students, I always give the example at the collective level. I talk about the automobile, the tremendous impact that has had on our society. And when you look at an individual automobile, it seems like an awesome invention that lets you go here and there as you wish. But when it's played out on a mass scale, then your entire society starts to change in profound ways.
Michael Bess is my guest. He's Chancellor's Professor of History at Vanderbilt University and author of a new book called Our Grandchildren Redesigned, Life in the Bioengineered Society of the Near Future. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Michael Bess, who is Chancellor's Professor of History at Vanderbilt University and author of Our Grandchildren Redesigned, Life in the Bioengineered Society of the Near Future. You can join our conversation by sending me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Michael, I got my first computer in about 1988, and let me tell you, it was state-of-the-art for 1988, and I'm very glad that I don't have to use it today. You write about the fact that it's possible some of the choices we make for ourselves to enhance ourselves or to correct problems might quickly become obsolete in the same way that our phones and computers and technologies do.
Yeah, and with some modification categories, that's not going to be a problem. For instance, if you're taking pills, you'll just update to the latest generation of whatever the fancy pills are that are trying to either boost your cognition or affect your emotions. With bioelectronic implants, it starts to become a little bit more dicey, especially if you've put those implants under your skin. But nowadays, some of the technologies, you just wear them as a headset, and they're getting more and more powerful. It's completely blowing me away when I look at the way where we were 10 years ago with some of these headsets that measure brain activity and can translate it into actions on your computer or on machines and like robots. There's just been an extraordinarily rapid growth. So maybe in that category, if it's something that you can put on, like a wearable technology, that might not be a problem. Genetic technologies, clearly, if you've made a DNA modification, let's say, in the hope of lowering your child's propensity to get cancer, and then 20 years later they find out that although it didn't have immediate side effects, it has some bad side effects down the line, or if they come up with a new genetic package, let's say, that new parents are now adopting that's far more effective, but it's incompatible with the existing DNA modification that you've made, then you're kind of stuck. And the ability to upgrade DNA modifications may be much more difficult, which is why this category that I mentioned earlier about epigenetic modifications, it gets around that problem because epigenetic modifications, as I say, you can do at any time in your life, and not all of them will be reversible, but many of them may be reversible. This is all speculative at this point because this is a very new area of genetic science. But from what I'm hearing from talking, you know, to researchers in the field, it's not inconceivable that these things will become available to us in the next 20 years or so. And they'll be tested in the animal world. They'll be tested with laboratory animals and so forth beforehand to make sure that they're safe. But some of these modifications that you make through the epigenetic pathway may be modifiable. And so then you sort of worry about humans, you know, in the book I talk about, you know, humans 95, humans XP, humans 7, humans 8, this kind of need to get on a rat race, just kind of like we are with our computers and our iPhones, where we're constantly having to go through the hassle of upgrading and, you know, getting new software and hardware, that we may have to be doing this as we integrate our identities with technology more and more and with these biotechnologies. We may be buying into a situation where we become a little bit like our computers.
You've written about this example of two young women applying for the same job, one of whom has had a lot of advantages with regard to adaptations that sort of make her bigger, better, faster, more, and another one who is, for lack of a better word, unenhanced by any artificial technology.
Yeah, and I think that that's really going to be a big problem for people who do choose to go non-modified. I think, and there will be quite a few people who take that choice for a variety of reasons. There's a movie, Gattaca, that tries to depict this, and I always say it's an interesting movie, but it's unrealistic because the Jude Law character in the film Gattaca is able, even though he can't be modified to the superhuman level of the other people, he's able by sheer willpower, the way he's depicted in the movie, to rise up to their level of performance just by sort of working at it with just a particular sort of ferocious determination. But I think that's unrealistic, because I think when people actually are modified in the, with the types of genetic and cognitive and bioelectronic modifications, sometimes working together in various combinations, they're going to run circles around unmodified people. They're going to be able to remember. They'll be able to interface with machines much more seamlessly and swiftly. They'll be able to process information. Maybe, you know, if you're a scientist, you could be running 10 different experiments at the same time, simply because you have the ability to hold that all in your mind all at once. That that scenario would render people very would put people at, you know, some people at tremendous disadvantage when you come to a competitive job market.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Henry in Dallas. Hi, Henry.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I guess my first comment is I thought it was interesting that you likened the whole thing to Moore's Law, which then I guess implies that there's a termination, you know, that at a certain point that it couldn't get better. Secondly, and my main comment was, I think philosophically, if we are able to do something, then because by proxy we are natural, then it is natural.
Well, thank you, Henry. The Moore's Law comparison is apt, and one of the things that I'm reading is just I read Scientific American sort of religiously. I absolutely love Scientific American. One of the things that I'm seeing there is that there doesn't seem to be any termination for Moore's Law, because they're going to keep finding new platforms. It seems like as soon as they hit a seemingly insurmountable obstacle by using one type of design and one set of materials, they're going to switch to a different type of technology. So the latest thing that I saw a couple issues back was something called a memristor, where your processor and your memory are in the same device, micro device, and you're not having to send stuff back and forth between memory and processing, and that gets around a lot of the Moore's Law modifications. So I don't really see that. It may be that biology poses more modification limits than we have just among machines. And so we may find that there are inherent limits, for example, to how far you can boost memory. Earlier we were talking about unintended effects. Let's say that you boost memory, somebody's ability to recall and retrieve information that they've absorbed earlier in the day or earlier in their lives. There's a point at which that can become counterproductive. Obviously, for functional memory to be working well for us, we have to be able to forget a lot of stuff so that our brains aren't overloaded by unnecessary information. So there's a possibility that there's an absolute limit to how well we can boost our memories. At a certain point, I think there may be diminishing returns. And the other question is, you know, if we're able, would this be natural? I don't really stick with the natural thing anymore, because as far as I look around at my society, the people around me, and even the non-human world, the parks, the places where, you know, I go when I want to go, quote unquote, into nature, all of it has now been affected by humans to such an extent that it's very hard to find any part of the planet, if any at all, that we can call pristine, original, primeval nature. So what we have instead is a broad spectrum, from highly artificial environments like downtown New York City to relatively untouched environments like Yellowstone Park. But you still have to realize that Yellowstone Park is in many ways a construct. Even just the idea that we're going to try to, you know, protect this piece of land and not mess with it too much, that's in itself almost a form of artifice. And of course, planes are flying overhead and things are happening to the aquifers underneath, because of human actions. And so I don't really buy anymore the distinction between purely natural and purely artificial. I think what we really have is a broad spectrum of hybrids that are sort of part natural and part artificial. And I think this is happening to the human body. And so to me, to say this is unnatural, that's not a powerful argument against these technologies. What is an argument against these technologies is when we put up the yardstick, the moral yardstick, and say, what will this do to our lives? What will this do to us, the quality of life of our lives as individuals? what are the qualities today that give our lives meaning and that, you know, we value most highly? And will these technologies actually be boosting, they're boosting our capabilities maybe, but will they be boosting our quality of life, the quality of our interactions with our loved ones, our ability to reach out and help each other? In some ways, yes, and in some ways, probably not. And so that's, to me, the moral yardstick that I use when I try to assess technologies. I'm asking, will they be augmenting our quality of life, or not just capabilities themselves for their own sake?
There's also this question of these augmentations. You know, when you think about them as being voluntary, provided we have sufficient wealth to pay for whatever it is we want to do to ourselves to make ourselves better, that's one thing. But yeah. I'm thinking about, you know, as we begin to understand there may be a genetic component to certain people with lifelong patterns of violent behavior, what if, you know, a government decided it's for the good of all society if we use epigenetics or some kind of modification to turn off that switch in everyone? It seems like a good idea, and yet it would be an experiment on an unprecedented scale on an entire population.
Yes, and unfortunately, you know, there's, as a historian now, you know, the track record has been very disturbing. You know, earlier in this century, there were eugenic modifications made to people against their will. People were forced to undergo sterilization if they didn't meet certain criteria for cognitive ability. And now we look back on those programs that, you know, the United States, we think of eugenics, we think of the Nazis, but unfortunately here in the United States, there was a powerful eugenics movement, some very prominent advocates for it, and we really violated the human rights of some of our own fellow citizens in some egregious ways in the name of doing this. What you find among the proponents of these kinds of modification is they generally tend to shy away from government-sponsored, you know, non-voluntary mass forms of modification. They say, look, this is going to be liberal eugenics. This is going to be chosen by individuals voluntarily for themselves. We should give people the right to modify themselves if they see fit, and in any way they see fit, as long as, you know, here's the John Stuart Mill clause, as long as my modifications don't hurt you or hurt society. But of course, that's the big question. To what extent, you know, are we going to be making things worse for large numbers of people if small numbers of people are getting access to these modifications and large numbers of people are not?
And you have to wonder as well about discrimination against people who have disabilities. Already there are, I think very sadly in my opinion, there are people who think that parents shouldn't have the right to bring a child into the world that they know will be disabled. And I wonder if similar arguments could be extrapolated if, you know, people said, well, you shouldn't bring someone into the world who is only going to be functioning normally and doesn't possess these enhancements that allow everyone else to be more productive.
Yeah, I mean, there are bioethicists who have published books that you can read today who basically say, if we can enhance, then we are morally bound to, because these people will have better lives according to the standards that we use today. And I don't buy those arguments at all. I think this is going to be an area where, first of all, people need to understand that there are pros and cons in these. There are really two camps. There are camps of wild enthusiasts who say, by all means, go for it, humankind. And then there are camps of people who hold up their hands in horror and say, absolutely not, we shouldn't do any of these things. And I tend to put myself somewhere more in between. I think these enhancements need to be judged on a case-by-case basis, one by one, according to that criterion that I mentioned earlier. Are they really augmenting our quality of life as individuals? Are they really making our society a better place to live in? If they pass those tests, then I'm not in principle opposed to them. But it's going to be hard. That's going to take time. And I guess one of the main messages of the book is it's first of all to proceed with humility, because we're tampering with something that's extraordinarily complex, both our individual makeup, the makeup of our organism, but also our social and cultural makeup. So we're tampering with something very complicated, and we should proceed carefully. And secondly, we should proceed slowly. There will be tremendous pressures to go faster, faster, faster. And already I see in my society around me, you know, people working harder and harder, and it seems like everybody is always out of breath and overworked and feeling stressed out. And I think that this tendency to go faster, faster, faster is we need to give ourselves time for our social and cultural patterns to adapt so that we find ways. Maybe these enhancements come in and we start seeing effects taking place, and we need to be able to say, how do we need to change our laws? How do we need to change how we educate our kids? How do we need to change how we see ourselves in how we see ourselves within nature? How do we see ourselves in relation to each other? These are going to be profoundly destabilized by the arrival of these enhancements. And if we go too quickly, we risk tearing our society apart.
One wonders about the differences between societies that are rich enough to provide these for their citizens or allow their citizens to purchase them individually as compared with those in the developing world that probably couldn't afford this.
I worry a lot about that. I mean, it's going to be bad enough in a society like, you know, the United States, which is a relatively wealthy society, and we already have tremendous disparities in access to education and health care in our nation. On a global scale, you know, places where people can't even get access to basic education, basic food, people are starving, no water, disease. It's very hard to imagine how such enhancement technologies would be made available to those people. And so then you really start to worry about a bifurcation of the human species into two separate castes, almost, biocastes. And that's a truly Orwellian nightmare scenario that I think we need to do everything we can to avoid.
Michael Bess is my guest. He's Chancellor's Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. We're talking about his new book, Our Grandchildren Redesigned, Life in the Bioengineered Society of the Near Future. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org. You can call 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Michael Bess of Vanderbilt University. His new book is Our Grandchildren Redesigned, Life in the Bioengineered Society of the Near Future. Michael, all of this also makes me think about human identity. So right now, you can be an athlete or a scholar or an entrepreneur whose success is the result of certainly some natural talent probably, but a great deal of hard work and focus and self-discipline. If suddenly we had the ability to put everyone literally on a level playing field, it wouldn't be so special anymore to be good at any of those things.
Right. And so we place a certain value on that component of hard work. Maybe it's, you know, part of our Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism sort of inheritance, that we have this ethic that you have to earn the things that you're good at. I think that there's always going to have to be, even for highly modified people, there's always going to have to be a strong component of work. I think, you know, even if you're taking a pill or you've made some epigenetic tweak to your cognition, you're still going to have to study. You're still going to have to work hard. By and large, I think that what you're going to see is a tremendous diversity of levels of people doing all kinds of different. Some of these things might be very creative and kind of wonderful to behold. There might be some splendid new configurations that people come up with for what it means to be human. And I don't want to downplay the potential positive effects of these enhancements. I mean, my book is I think at one level these enhancements are going to sell themselves, so right. to speak. So I don't have to do that in my book. And the first part of the book, I try to lay out what are the realistic possibilities based on extrapolating from what the experts are saying they think is going to be possible over the coming decades. But I think, you know, by and large, these things, if you can live longer, let's say, and have a live in full possession of your mental and physical abilities and feel like a 35-year-old all the way to 120 or 130 or 140, that's something that you're not going to have to do a lot of advertising for. But then the question becomes, what happens to our society when you have five generations of people living together in the same family? What happens if, you know, what happens if a very, very, this is one example I bring up in the book. What happens if someone who's actually chronologically 35 years old falls in love with someone who looks 35 and has, you know, the mental, full mental acuity of a 35-year-old but is 135? Excuse me. So when that happens, you're going to have two people who have a tremendous disparity of experience, a tremendous disparity of accumulated memories, and yet somehow maybe they'll fall in love. What will their relationship be like? What will be the new problems that they encounter? What will be the new creative and beautiful things that they're able to make happen in their world? Positives and negatives. And this is the sort of recurring refrain for me. We're going to be able to take the people's natural talents and boost them in some ways. There will be both positive and negative results.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Sterling in Fort Worth. Hi, Sterling.
Hi. I think one thing that kind of gets overlooked in this entire discussion is the fact that there's already a huge disparity in just natural genetics. And with the possibility of genetic modification, we actually have the ability to even the playing field, and allow people to be sort of the master of their own destiny instead of the victim of circumstance.
What do you think, Michael?
I think that that's true. I'm more inclined, and there are going to be two different types of pressures that I see as possibilities, and I kind of debate with myself which one is going to be the more preponderant. I talk about a pressure toward homogeneity, and I talk about a pressure toward diversification. And I think both are going to be there sort of in competition with each other, tugging against each other. The pressure for homogeneity is evidenced in our society today by when you drive into a new suburb of your town and you realize even though the houses have some individual differences, they all are sort of, there's this master checklist of certain kinds of granite countertops and high ceilings and, you know, automatic garage door openers and gabled ceiling roofs outside. They all look at some level and feel very similar. We do that with our consumer products. And I think if human beings start to become part of a consumer market and how they get shaped through these various technologies, there's going to be a pressure for homogeneity at one level. You're going to find fads. You're going to find certain, you know, people looking at their neighbors and saying, I want that too. And that's going to bring things, people to a more similar level. And like, you know, as you say, there's a certain liberating effect if it's possible for people who didn't win out in the natural genetic lottery. Let's say that everybody somehow got financial access to getting these technologies, maybe it could level the playing field. But the other side is, I think, people are going to choose to express their individuality by then observing some of the fads and some of the homogenizing tendencies and go their own separate way. And I think you're going to find a lot of people just as some people in today's society refuse to live in a planned community, those gated communities, they want to live in a funky old house in an edgy part of town because that's part of their way of sort of expressing their unique individuality. You're going to find people also modifying themselves in those ways. The big question for me is, If you're going to be able to level the playing field, Sterling, in the way that you're saying, how will we make sure that everyone in the society gets access to the requisite technologies? That's going to be a tremendous challenge when we have today so much of a challenge getting people access to health care and education on an equal basis.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, right now we're still debating over who deserves comprehensive health care and whether it's a right or a privilege that belongs to those who have the money to pay for it. And it's the same with education.
Yes.
It doesn't seem that human nature or the nature of American culture is going to change to the extent that we can all agree on who deserves these modifications.
If that's the case, then I think you're going to see certain societies getting much more equal access, like, you know, the Scandinavian countries, for example, will be the ones that pioneer more equal access, just as they today make every effort to, you know, give equal access to education and healthcare to all their citizens. They'll probably be the ones who want to see their whole population have access to these enhancement technologies. And in a country like the United States, where culturally many people have been much more resistant to that, and that's been expressed in government policies, then you might find an actual exacerbation of today's disparities. I always it horrifies me, the possibility of this, because today somebody who's born in a poor part of town and has all these disadvantages of being poor, you still find individuals who work their way out of that. Maybe they're born with natural talent, and maybe they're partly very lucky, and maybe they're very hardworking, and that combination allows them to rise out and, you know, become a CEO of some big corporation. This is going to be much more difficult if the capabilities of people are written into their biology. And you're going to start seeing these disparities that today we see among people actually written into people's biology. And of course, if you can do that for yourself, then you're going to be able to do it for your family, because with your augmented capabilities, you'll probably have a higher income that'll make you able to buy even more enhancements for your children, who will in turn have all those advantages. So you have a spiral going upward for those who have access to the technologies, whereas those who don't are sort of stagnating down below. And then that divergence is not just one that's kind of happening to people because of access to education and healthcare. It's happening because their very biology is now diverging, and that scares me.
What do you think we might deal with in terms of, you know, people pressuring one another to take on these enhancements? You know, there are many people who are, you know, have a business partner or even a romantic partner, and they say this would be perfect if you were only more organized, or if you were the kind of person who managed money in this way. And it might seem that people, you know, might sign off on these things as if they are personal choices, but in fact feel a great deal of pressure to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I can already imagine, you know, what a prenup is going to look like in the year 2040. I will marry you if you, you know, download.
You'll be 35
this,
forever.
If this is 35 forever and this particular Google package, which I recommend to you, you know, and so that's one very, very real possibility. You think of the way people prepare themselves today for their professions. So I want to be a musician, let's say. I get a certain kind of education. I have my natural musical ability, but I also have to practice in order to get my dexterity to express itself in whatever, let's say I play the violin. If these enhancements become available, that will allow me probably to tweak both my inherent musical, let's say the auditory cortex in my brain, but also the physical dexterity, the way I am able to coordinate my movements and to fine-tune my movements in my hand and my arm. And I'll be able to modify myself in a pre-professional way that makes me much more competitive within the market, you know, of musicians trying to get jobs in symphonies and things like that. Now, you imagine this phenomenon spreading through all the different professions in society, become a doctor, become a lawyer, become whatever, a business person. You start to realize this pre-professional specialization will cause people to adopt very different sets of enhancements, some of which, maybe many of which, will not be reversible.
Hmm.
And So today, you know, you go to a party where there are, to say, it's a party where it's predominantly medical people, doctors. There will be a certain homogeneity there because just, you know, there'll still be diverse individuals, but because they've all had the same type of professional training. Now imagine that they've undergone this much higher level pre-professional specialization. They're likely to be even more homogeneous than today. That's going to be, and so you start getting a clustering effect in society as people go down these different paths.
So how can we prepare for a time when these enhancements are far more common and not theoretical?
One of the things I emphasize in the book is this is speculation. Nobody knows what the future is going to be like. And so at one level, you know, this is just an exercise in sort of educated guesses about the future. But I think the way we can prepare ourselves the most is to be aware that these things are quite possible, many of them, and that they're coming at us more quickly than we might expect or than we might assume. And start educating ourselves about them. And so that when, because I do believe that these are not inevitable technologies. No technology is inevitable. Technologies are not an impersonal force that comes from outside of human society and somehow then humans have to adapt to it. Ultimately, technologies can seem like that kind of impersonal force because no single one of us gets to choose them. Unless you're Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, even there, you know, they're responding to certain needs within the society. Even those geniuses who lead the way are still responding to societal needs. We can't stop these technologies from going forward, but we can channel the flow of the development of these technologies down one direction as opposed to another. And I think as consumers, we exercise a lot of power that way. We also can elect, you know, government officials who can regulate these technologies so that certain types of clearly harmful technologies don't get pursued and don't get developed, and the energy and the resources go into developing other biotechnologies that are not clearly harmful but seem to promise good outcomes.
Michael Bess is Chancellor's Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. He's author of a new book called Our Grandchildren Redesigned, Life in the Bioengineered Society of the Near Future. Michael, it's been a really interesting conversation, and I so appreciate you making this time for us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.